Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everybody. It is Down, South, and Dirty with Scout Smith and Stacey Hopkins. Finna bring it to y'all once again. Before we go into to what the show is going to be about today, we would love to take a moment of silence for a warrior that has passed on to the other village, Julian Bond. So let's take a slight moment of silence. Okay, everybody. It kind of hit all of us kind of a surprise when I woke up this morning to see Julian had passed on. But we all know that he was somebody that fought for the freedom and equality of all human beings. We know that he was a contemporary of the late Dr. Martin Luther King and so many of our civil rights warriors. And it's sad that he's passed on.
Right, and
go ahead.
I think you know, he's definitely lived a life well lived and a full life, and it wasn't without its controversy. But I think for the younger generation, they need to understand the battles that Julian Bond was in, particularly the work he did in his life with SNCC, with NAACP. It was a different time than what we have now, and those organizations were a little bit different from what we see now, but you can't deny the contributions he brought to the table. And not a lot of black people know that when Julian Bond was elected to the Georgia legislature, they didn't want to feed him. And that was a nasty little fight. So if you aren't aware of what this man did in his life and what he stood for, you know, Google it and don't just stop. Like, just don't start from the 80s. Go all the way back and learn about what he did. So I thank him for it, and my condolences go out to his son, who sits on the Atlanta City Council, Julian Bond, Michael Julian Bond, and the Bond family. You know, our hearts are heavy with you today. So,
yeah, but
with
okay.
That said,
today's show is about black and white spaces, particularly black spaces. Over the last couple of weeks, you know, in particular with the merging of what's happening with Black Lives Matter and the Bernie Sanders campaign and the whole presidential race is building up, and we've noticed the issue that is kind of getting us, that we know we have white allies in the movement for social justice and equality, and sometimes they find themselves in very uncomfortable situations when we as blacks, African Americans, member of the, you know, of African descent, you know, when we get upset about some things, when we, you know, as some people say, we get in our feelings and we become angry or very excited, they don't always take very well. Or when we are in situations in which they are planning to be entertained and we are trying to get business done, they will get mad because they can't get their entertainment, and we're trying to get our business done. And let me give you an example of what I'm talking about here. I'm not going to that one yet. That's coming. That's going to come when we talk about this dirty list. But, you know, as a member of the Democratic side of things, you know, there's a lot of times when we have speakers come in and this, that, and the other, and it's pretty much the preacher preaching to the choir most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
And they are okay with that. And sometimes we be kind of like, okay, so we hear what you're saying, but what you going to do about something? And when we start making that cry about what we going to do, they get mad. Well, hold on, let's listen to what he got to say. We know what he going to say. We the choir, he the preacher. We finna hear him, going to go along with the sermon. Okay, we already know this. So what we not going to talk about is what we going to do, because the pastor just didn't preach that we need to go out and help the sick and shut in. We done sung a hymn about it. Are we going to get up and go out into the streets and actually go see some sick and shut in?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so it comes down to that level. And, you know, if you're in the church, you understand what I'm talking about. And so we like to hear the preacher preach a good sermon, but when folks start yelling, amen, and yes, pastor, what are we going to do something? They getting, you got those that sit up in the top of on the motherboard and the deacons up in the deacon seats talking about should the pastor preach. That's kind of what white liberals do to the black folk when we start talking.
And it's not just the political side. It's on the advocacy side too.
Right.
And there's a lot of I'm not saying that your intentions aren't well meaning. But there's a lot of you out, or not a lot, but there's some of y'all out there doing it all wrong. And we're kind of doing this as a public service kind of thing because, you know, we see things and we've experienced it ourselves, and we're trying to help y'all navigate this, because the only way we're going to fix this is if we all play our respective parts and work together towards a common goal. Now, there's a saying we have in the black community, stay in your lane. Sometimes white people have to step back and you have to stay in your lane because y'all are treading over into territory. And I've seen some conversations on social media. I've had some personally where I'm like, you know what? If you weren't talking to me, you would get jacked up and there's nothing I can do to help.
There is
nothing I can do to help. So that's kind of the premise behind today's show, trying to help y'all navigate.
We got some guests calling in to at the quarter hour mark. So right quick, let's go through our dirty list, because I got an extensive one this morning. I don't know about you, so I'm going to let you go first.
Okay, mine is kind of short. Of course, still DeKalb County is on the dirty list for the stadium. I don't know if y'all saw CEO Lee May throw his chest out and talk about, you know, well, this is the best deal we could have made, and it, you know, this type of development will be good for the community. That's not the point. And the point is that the way that deal was done, it was done with no transparency, and it was shoved down the people's throats. And elected officials need to understand, y'all have to stop doing this. You know, you've got rebellions on both sides of the aisle going on that are coming out of the same place. So DeKalb County is still on my dirty list. Mayor of Atlanta, Kasim Reed. Now, they are going to use, the city of Atlanta is going to use eminent domain to close the Peachtree Pine homeless shelter. If anyone is familiar with the area, it takes up just about a city block, and it's a piece of prime property in Midtown. Now, this area has been going through a renaissance, and, of course, you know, those who are moving back in after abandoning the city can't really have a homeless shelter
with those who are least fortunate around us. And, you know, I mean, I'll be the first to say that the area can be a little rough, but you have people, this is all representatives of what the city has failed. So Mayor Reed comes in and says, okay, we're going to build something new for these homeless people. We're going to put a, because they got TB, they threw in the TB scare, which is, you know, it's like in search of disease here, Ebola, TB, et cetera, et cetera. And we're going to build something, which came to a shock to everybody, because if you could build a facility for the homeless, why haven't you done it before? And then maybe you can get those people who are in front of City Hall and the Gold Dome off of there, because you've got people who live on the wall. And, you know, they are, you know, he's coming in and saying we're going to do this and dislocate these people. I got to give big ups to Anita Beatty. She has been fighting this for a while, but what, man, we all know nothing's going to get built. No, nothing's going to happen with these homeless people. And Mayor Reed needs to be ashamed of herself for, A, the eminent domain, which is basically the state saying, I'm not going to ask you, I'm going to take it, and for throwing the TV scare in there. That was just horrible. And then the last on my dirty list is all the folks tripping over Straight out of Compton and calling in just about the National Guard because we're going to see this movie. You know, it's actually kind of ironic because you're acting, you know, you're trying to militarize the movie theater, and this movie talks about the problems, you know, it speaks to directly what we're going through now with police violence and brutality. So that was kind of a real asshole-ish move by the theaters to kind of double down on that. So that's real quick my down south and dirty list for this week. So what do you got on yours?
Well, first on mine, as I'm still tired of folks dying burning. I mean, I went to me and you both went to a Young Democrats meeting,
mm-hmm.
and Bernie Sanders supporters were the only people who sent somebody to speak on behalf of his campaign. And the majority of people, I'm not saying that y'all liked him, but y'all were very receptive to what we had to say. And a lot of, you know, folks talking about, well, do black people support Bernie? I don't know. I've yet to talk to a black person yet that openly tells me they don't like Bernie. I mean,
and then
I'm
when you do tell them, they
not one that knows the business.
And then when
so,
you do tell, if they don't know and you tell them, they're like, oh, yeah.
Okay, we got you. My second one, and this is the first time I probably done called somebody out by name. Okay? If you follow me on social media, Scott Smith on Facebook, you probably saw my rant earlier in the week about about black conservatives. Okay? And people are probably wondering where that came from. There's a young man in North Carolina by the name of Marquise Young. Okay? He's on Twitter as Young Black Republican. He claims he used to be a Democrat back in the day, and now he's a Republican. And
is he another Andre Walker?
And he claimed, his claim to fame is that he came up with the hashtag "Why I'm Not Voting for Hillary," and the conservative establishment will, you know, cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs over him. And it's not the fact that he's a conservative. It's not because he's black. It's because he has been pushing this one little piece of information that pisses me off every time I see a black conservative use it. And it's something that I didn't even do when I was a Republican. We know that Lincoln was a Republican and he freed the slaves, okay? We understand.
We're not doing that still.
Yeah. We understand that during the Reconstruction, all of the African Americans that were in office were Republicans, okay? We feel you. We understand that because we are students of history. And as students of history and also of political science, we also understand that the Republican Party of 1860 to 1871 is not the same party that exists today, all right?
And vice versa for the Democrats.
Because guess what? Those same Republicans in 1876 sold us the hell out when they made the deal with the Dixiecrats to disenfranchise us. Oh, but we don't like to talk about that now, do we? You run around like Stephen on the doggone plantation because these white folks on the conservative side is giving you some props. You ain't nothing but they pet, boy. You need to get that understanding in your head and never forget where you come from and who your people are, because they're African-American conservatives who still understand at the end of the day in this country called the United States of America that they are black. And one of them that I won't give a shout-out to for constantly keeping his eyes on police brutality is the United States Senate candidate on the Republican side, Derek Grayson. Because regardless of all the stuff Derek says he's keeping his eyes on the popo because he understands that they're violating the Constitution. Okay, the next one that I got, and this is going to be it before I go into my segue into the show, is the black elite in Philadelphia. There's a young lady by the name of Leah Wright. There's a young lady by the name of Leah Wright who wants to run for city council up there. They got her kicked off the ballot on some bullshit-ass technicalities. Y'all need to be shaming yourself because we should never be afraid of a little democracy. All right, my last, and then I'm finna have my segue. Yesterday, we had on social media, and I got my feelings hurt because I got some friends of mine who slightly, I'm worried about you because you said some things yesterday that made me wonder, are you truly an ally or do you understand what being an ally is? So as we get ready to come in here, we got our first guest host coming in. Let me go ahead and log on.
Thank you.
Hello.
Hello. How are you?
Hi. I want to make an apology right off because, you know, I'm on my way to the show that I do on Sundays, and so I'm outside of the MARTA station, so please forgive me, everybody.
Oh, that's okay. I mean, I'm cooking as we speak, so, you know, we multitask like that. But
okay.
For listeners who are coming in, we're speaking with Dawn Gibson. She's a friend of the show and a local community activist and organizer. Dawn serves on the Coordinating Committee of Hello Racism, which is a group that helps to facilitate dialogue between the white and black communities. She's also acting host of the Thursday edition of the Progressive News Hour on WRFG 89.3, and she is co-host of the Arena Uncensored. If you want, now, we try to keep it real. I got to give y'all props. Y'all keep it raw on Arena Uncensored.
Yeah.
And also, Dawn is a very dear friend of mine. I love her to death, but you know, and it's good to have friends you can tell to put on your show. So I want to thank you for coming in and helping us with this discussion because it's been rough out there for not only black people but for white allies trying to navigate, because I've seen some conversations on social media. And I just sat back there and just looked and said, oh, my. There's, you know, I think with the Black Lives Matter activists challenging the campaign and forcing some much-needed discussions that, you know, we're hearing things from white allies that we feel that needs a course correction. One of the biggest things that came up, you know, after the Bernie Sanders interruption, you know, we heard an outroar of anger come from the white community. I myself, I have to admit, I did have some anger, but it wasn't so much towards Black Lives Matter and what they were saying. It was that I feel that they're being manipulated politically by powers that they don't really understand. That's a whole other thing. That's just my personal stuff. I own it. But I wanted you to help us out. You know, there was some discussions. There was some bloggers talking about, you know, how to be an ally to the black community. There was some discussion about the word being an ally, whether we need that. But tell us a little bit more about the work you guys do at Hello Racism, and let's start to talk about how to be a good ally.
Okay, I might take up a little bit of space with this because I feel like it's important for your listeners to understand who I am as a person when I'm answering this question and from which perspective that I'm coming from. I want to thank you, Stacy. Definitely, you know, I embrace your friendship. I am grateful, you know, for me, you know, when we get together and speak, it is a celebration of Black womanhood. And even though, you know, you and I might disagree politically on things, and this is not to say we disagree on issues. We might disagree on solutions, which is, you know, more of what we talk about when we talk about politics. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I really value your input, and I appreciate you holding me accountable as well.
I don't believe
anything I heard about you, Scout. But no, I'll just play it. I heard good stuff about you. But so I have a sense of humor because I'm about to say some serious stuff. Okay. I am the child of moderate Black parents. And when I say moderate Black parents, my parents did not march with Dr. King. My parents were not part of the freedom struggle. My parents were raising children and working a job. My father graduated from Penn State University as an engineer in 1973, which is a feat for Black people at the time, you know, something that was unusual. My mother is also college educated, although she got her degree right before I got my first college degree. I am grateful to my parents for instilling me a pride in myself as a Black person. Even though I grew up in a lot of predominantly white spaces, and I grew up with a lot of white friends that I still call friends today, you know, they still gave me a pride in of myself, aside from the life, of course. You know, I am an alum of Georgia State University. My first college degree was in 96. My second one was in 2005. I used to be an English teacher for 4 years. In addition, I started work on an English master's degree with a women's studies certificate, and that's where I was radicalized, which basically for me allows me to see how systemic racism works, not just here in the United States, but all over the world. White allies need to understand this. This has to be part of the discussion. I think one of the problems with a lot of, you know, allies is that, you know, for years, leaders in our community have been coming forward and repeating ad nauseum the suffering of Blacks in the United States. The fact that these two sisters said this at Bernie Sanders' rally, I mean, they're just repeating what, you know, well-known people have been saying for years. And unfortunately, many people have not listened. I think that what's unfortunate, and I will say that I tend to veer towards a Black nationalist ideology, which is not about white hatred. It is about Black love and representing the needs of my people. So for me, the problem that I have is that a lot of times nice white people, and I think that there are a lot of them out there, feel that it's more important to, you know, feel good about themselves rather than speak out and get in trouble regarding, you know, the injustice, the murders, the abuse, the mass incarceration of Black people here in the United States. I find it interesting that a lot of times when we talk about police brutality, and that is, you know, that is actually one issue that the Black Lives Matter protests have been focusing on. They have not been focusing on mass incarceration. They have not been focusing on housing injustice or gentrification. This is not to say that the people who have been involved in the Black Lives Matter movement are not concerned about those issues. But if we're trying to tell you about having, you know, a plan about what to do about these police and you don't have it, you know, that's a serious problem. And this is not, you know, singling out, you know, Bernie Sanders, you know, Hillary Clinton. You know, by the way, you know, I'm gonna shade Will Jeff here because he came out with that whack ass apology talking about, oh, I'm so sorry, and basically he's just campaigning for his wife for president. Because an apology, you know, think about some of the things that have happened because of Bill Clinton's presidency. The increase of mass incarceration and the three strikes laws, the removal of Pell Grants, or at least severely restricting access to Pell Grants for incarcerated people, and not the least also of putting through legislation that made it difficult for Troy Davis to demand a retrial after being wrongly convicted and wrongly executed by the state for the murder of a police officer. So, I'm going to tell you right off, I have no love for the Clintons. And I was an 18-year-old. I voted for Bill Clinton. I was a black person that believed that the Democrats were the party for black people. And, you know, Bill Clinton came on Arsenio Hall show. I'm just going to keep it real. He came on and blew the saxophone, and I was like, yo, he on Arsenio. That's cool. I used to be friendly towards Hillary Clinton. As an 18-year-old who was not politically educated, of course I would. But in 2015, I am 41 years old. You know, when I think about the people who have come before me, the people in my life who inform me, the things that I see, you know, Hillary's not even a worthy part of this conversation because I know she lying. But anyway, I didn't mean to go off about I just wanted to express that, you know, while I might be critical of Sanders, it is not out of a love for Hillary Clinton, because, you know, and this is not to say that she is responsible for her husband's presidential record. I just want to call out that whack-ass apology talking about, I'm sorry. You know what an apology is? I'm sorry. You better pay some people. You better make sure that you expunge the records of those people who have been incarcerated. You know, you need to do a whole lot more, and there's a whole lot more they can do, because I will point out that while it was amazing that the first black president, after presidents having supported the mass incarceration state, you know, when it blew up in the 70s, you know, to the present time, and when, you know, the 13th Amendment was ratified, where it abolishes slavery in one form and reinforces it if you are convicted of a crime, a thing that has been exploited definitely by the state of Georgia through convict leasing and chain gangs. So while people are trying to say, you know, you need to get over slavery, you know, I'm just like, okay, well, let's talk about the black codes, you know, convict leasing, chain gangs, sharecropping, you know. You know, I think I said Jim Crow, but I'll say it again. You know,
right.
I would also push people to see I recommend the book, The New Jim Crow, by Michelle Alexander. By no means a radical text, but a mainstream text that lays out, you know, a fairly decent comprised history of concise history of white supremacy in the United States. That would be chapter one, in which even Martin Luther King was considered part of the criminal element as he was fighting for our rights. So, and I will also say to, you know, lift up Dr. King, you know, even though our politics would be different, we would have some disagreements on things, but everybody mm-hmm. keeps bringing up that I have a dream speech. And you know what?
No,
they only bring up
no.
the last 2 minutes. Know what?
When
they bring up the speech?
Well, you know, and a lot of people forget about how radical Dr. King was getting towards the end of his life. And for me, the seminal moment was when he said, "We're coming to get that check." And
you know
what?
I play that video for breakfast.
You know, and
you know,
and,
we
you
about
know,
that check.
We about that check, and somebody said, "Oh hell no, you ain't," and took care of that. But you know, I think
and when he talked about the war in Vietnam and our collusion in it, and you know, people always go to the more bridge building Dr. King, or the more the one that makes them comfortable, and that's one of the problems that I have when we talk about race. You know, white people want to be in a space that's comfortable for them, and they need to understand,
yes,
this conversation is not about your comfort. This is not.
No.
This is about you facing your whiteness and how you benefit from white supremacy and white privilege. But and it will be uncomfortable, and it's not a condemnation of you personally. But if you say you want to work to build these bridges, you have to understand how you benefit from it, how what to, and how it manifests itself in your speech. How, you know, we talked about systemic racism, institutionalized racism. You know, there's so many different facets of it where people unwittingly participate in it. And, you know, now black people, before we were kind of like, well, you know, it's the good white folks uptown, they're trying to help us. And now there's a new awareness where we're like, no, you know what, I need to check you on this. You know, the old Occupy mic check. You've been throwing mic checks all over. So that's kind of one of the reasons we wanted to do this show, because, you know, I was just kind of stunned at the reaction, you know, when you brought up Bernie Sanders. And and the Black Lives Matters. But remember when Occupy launched in Atlanta, right?
I know exactly what you're about to talk about too.
Okay, you know what I'm going to talk
about. By the way,
before
you even say the name, you know, I also want to point out to your audience that, you know, we lost one of the warriors from the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, Julian Bond. May he rest in power. But you're referring to Occupy Wall Street's block of John Lewis, a block that, you know, I did not necessarily disagree with. However, it has made Occupy Atlanta well known all over the place. And the way it looked, and I would even say even beyond that, that Occupy had been deficient in their analysis on race. And you know, what usually if you try to usually what you try to say to folks about, hey, you know, there's this thing going on with black folks, they'll say, well, I'm just here to get the money out of politics. That was a lot of the reactions that a lot of people got. And, you know, I would also say that there was a distinct lack of education regarding Julian Bond and John Lewis's history. You know, I tend to be more on the Julian Bond than I am John Lewis, but you know, it wasn't that they just marched with King. I mean, you know, a lot of people marched with King. You're talking about, you know, a fiery John Lewis, you know, who probably would have actually done the same thing to himself back during the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, because when you do a little, when you listen to some of what, you know, some of the folks have come forward and said, you know, you're just like, wow, these are people.
Right.
You know, they are giants, but they are also people. And I will also say that considering the civil rights period, I also want to, you know, because I love Julian Bond, one of the things that he was quoted by Charles S. Cobb, the author of the book That Nonviolent Stuff Will Kill You, and Charles S. Cobb was also a former member of SNCC. He was saying that, you know, the way white people imagine the civil rights movement was Rosa Parks sat down, Martin stood up, white people, you know, changed their mind, and then everything was better. I gave sort of like, you know, like the, you
that
know,
was a good synopsis.
Translation of that. But, you know, I think that you are so 100% right, Stacey, when you say that a lot of people don't know about Dr. King's politics. What they focus on is, you know, he said that he wanted his children to be judged by the content of their character and not by the color of their skin, and that, you know, he was hoping for a world where little black boys and little black girls will play with little white boys and little white girls. When they think about King, they think about those lines. The I Have a Dream speech is much longer than that. It is 17 minutes long. I used to actually teach it to my composition and rhetoric class because Dr. King was a master rhetorician. You know,
yes,
our preachers
got
can
nothing
preach,
on them.
But I will tell you, he took language to a level. In that same speech, he accused America of reneging on their promise to the what he refers to as the American Negro, and that it was like being given a check marked insufficient funds. You know, I think Dr.
Mm-hmm.
King likes those checks,
right,
too. And additionally, he was talking about a promissory note that you defaulted on. You know, he was very critical of police brutality. He was very vocal, and he also, in Letter from Birmingham Jail, he said, and I'll give you the Dawn translation because, you know, I can't do his words justice, but he says, like, I ain't worried about, you know, well, I'm worried, but I'm not focusing so much on the Ku Klux Klan, your grand wizard, you know, the people coming out saying, I'm gonna get them black people. He finds, as we do in 2015, that our biggest obstacle is the white moderate. And the white moderate that basically says, hey, I agree with you, but these things take time. Are you sure that's the right thing to do? I think you
right.
should do this. And Dr. King said that. I'm not making it up. I will also
right.
say that, you know, because people don't think about Dr. King in terms of his opposition to Vietnam, which was not a common political view that, you know, the majority of the civil rights movement espoused. You know, it made King actually very unpopular. You know, King, like I said, they called him a criminal element. People were just like, well, I don't know about this Dr. King. I agreed with him, but now, so basically, these sisters who interrupted Bernie Sanders, and I will say that, you know, I think they should interrupt all of them, in my opinion, you know, but that's
right.
just me. You know, I think that, you know, we are well over time sitting down and listen quietly to any politician trying to tell us some stuff and be like, you've forgotten who works for who, and we're going
right.
about to tell you today. You're going to learn today. But
okay.
I also think that one of the things, because you and I have talked about this, one of the things that I've experienced coming, because even though I might not necessarily agree with the action because of other stuff I know that I will not talk about here, but, you know, the way they came for these sisters, I have seen everything from these
Girl.
Sisters being compared to Bill Cosby and Ben Carson, the female version.
No.
And this was in a leftist group. This was in a leftist group. You know, and you know what? This is where I have to come, you know, let you know. And this is something that I have learned from the ancestors, from people in my life, from, you know, unpopular people, you know, that a lot of white people feel very uncomfortable about, that I assert very publicly that, you know, as white allies, if you are truly our allies, what you should know is that you do not have the right to tell us who our leaders are. You do not have the right to tell us who our friends are. Y'all tried to do this with Mandela, and he let you know. He say, yo, I'm just little, you know, I'm not saying Mandela is perfect, but he let y'all know. You know, there are black people who have been letting folks know for a while, like, we choose our leaders. You know, we are
right.
agents. We are sentient beings. We do not need white people to tell us what we should do and what we should not do. You know, feminists do the same thing.
Right. And my whole thing is if they had the answers, what were you doing all this time? I mean, if you know all the answers, why are we in this situation that we're in? But we also have a mutual friend of ours in the cohort on the line, our second guest for the show. Scout, you want to tell
My
us about
from
Lady?
My another mister.
Yes.
And I'm sorry if you've been holding up for a second. But we got Lady Manfield here, who's the founder of Hello Racism, a journalist and an organizer, and co-host of the Monday edition of Progressive News Hour on WRFG 89.3 FM. Lady, welcome to Down South and Dirty.
All right. Thank you all so much. It's been good to hear the conversations. Thank you, Stacey, for holding it down. Thank you, Don, for speaking the truth. So it's been good.
That's our Dawn.
That is our Dawn. We're still listening. And I was actually being kind of nice today.
She really was, because Dawn's going to call it in concrete. I can attest to that.
Okay. All right. Well, I'm glad to be a part of the show.
Thank you. Been a big fan of the work that you're doing. It's really hard with everything that's going on to make it to all of them, but I've been keeping my eye out and looking and going, okay, lady, do your thing, girl, do your thing. But we were talking about, you know, spaces, and you've heard some of the conversations. Tell us a little bit about the work that you do at Hello Racism.
Well, Hello Racism is an organization that was designed directly to address, and not just address, but to also make actions towards Black liberation. So we talk a lot about people of color. Right now we are definitely focusing on Black folks here and what liberation looks like, liberation that we control, right? How we control our own destiny, what that means to control that destiny, and how do we do it looking at a lens through systemic racism, not just individual racism, but what does it mean to be in the Western world underneath capitalism and white supremacy that governs the entire system. So we do a lot of education, or we're trying to do a lot of educations, also some actions that have been uplifting Black lives, but also addressing the issues, and we're moving forward with that. So it's definitely an organization that's confronting white supremacy and empowering our communities through it.
Okay, so you have white people who attend your meeting. How difficult has it been for them to navigate and respect Black spaces when you're trying to create this dynamic to launch these actions?
Okay.
Yeah, let's go there.
Yeah. Thank you, Stacey, of course. Okay, so sometimes it's difficult, but I will say this. A lot of times it depends on us holding those spaces, and I'm talking directly about white and Black people. So what we have intentionally had conversation around and intentionally discussed is, what does it look like for us to hold our own spaces and invite other people that are not Black into those spaces? And even what spaces do we invite others in? So when we do have things like, for instance, race discussions, some of those race discussions are discussions where white people are invited into that space. And because we are having a race discussion that are led by mostly women of color, sometimes Black men, because we're having a race discussion that are led by Black people saying that we are actually leading this discussion, this organization, we're leading this moment that you're in, sometimes it's difficult for white people to actually be able to accept that, because historically privilege tells us, our white privilege, that whiteness equals superiority, whiteness equals the fact, whiteness is the beginning. And so when you come into a space and you're told that, you know, we're not really, we're acknowledging you in this space, we're valuing what you say, but you have to say it in our time, then that can be very difficult, because this challenges what we all experience. Whether you're Black or white, it challenges the status quo. It challenges the way business has been done. So it's been tough. You know, we have had those that are white come into the spaces and, you know, not be comfortable, start to feel like we're being isolated, start to feel like, wait a minute, you're segregating. In one of the race discussions, we separated Black people and white people. And there was someone that was white that was there that said, you know, I don't like this. I feel like it's segregation. And
wow.
It was kind of ironic. right.
They have no idea.
Right, because we have to directly in those spaces acknowledge it, but because you feel like it's segregated doesn't mean that we're about to integrate this. Now, you have to actually go through that section, deal with your emotions, and if we're really addressing white supremacy, deal with the reason why you feel like this was segregation, but you've been okay with it being done to us for years.
Ooh.
So it's a difficult transition for a lot of people in that space, and not just white people, black people.
Right.
So black people say, wait a minute. This doesn't feel comfortable. What do you mean we're putting black voices? Something that we say, done, let this. In one of the events we had, that we're going to prioritize black voices. And we had someone of color that identified themselves as black say, wait a minute, I want to make sure we're fair. Well, we had to go through that moment and say, this is fair. What's not fair is that you haven't been given priority over history. That's what we're working on.
I won't say what I think about that.
So it is uncomfortable, but it's something that we have to do. And if there are our white allies saying that we really want to do this work around race, then privilege has to be addressed. We have to confront what I call undeserved privilege, which means that you're given that because of conditions you're born in that you have no control of. You haven't necessarily earned it, or it has not been dis-earned, but you got it simply because you were born and you looked a certain way. You came from a certain heritage, so we say, and so you have that privilege. And that has to be confronted. You have to be able to say, you know what, I function in a world with a privilege that I didn't work for.
I have a question, because you said something just here earlier that kind of evoked some memories for me as I was, you know, back in my days down in Troup County, because we have, you was talking about how not only white people, you know, feel like they can take a privilege in our space, but we have some of our own people who are willing to give up our space to their privilege. And so my question is, I've seen this happen particularly in rural Georgia, where you have a couple of white allies that are walking the door, and the white allies usually bring resources with them. And we feel like because these people bring either money or they bring connections to the group or whatever, that they should be given priority over something that doesn't necessarily directly affects them. So how do we deal with those? How do you educate people to be able to deal with those situations?
Well, I think one of the ways of doing that, and not having all the answers, but figuring out or working through some of this, is by us understanding the system that we live in. I think that that education or knowledge, let me use the word knowledge. Knowledge is very empowering. And in our country and the Latin Western world, we've been miseducated. We've been indoctrinated with white supremacy values, white supremacy views. We've been indoctrinated with all of those things that tells us we're at the bottom and this other group is at the top. And there's a hierarchy. Of course, white men are always at the top. But we've had that. And so I think part of that is also being able to not just say, you don't give away your privilege, that this is your space and you have it, but also us understanding what that system is, understanding why we actually feel the way we do, why we believe that because someone has brought money into their space that we're willing to sacrifice what we want or what we have in order to cater to that person, because it's a lot deeper than the money. It's a lot deeper. We've been trained. It's been ingrained in us that our skin complexion puts us at the bottom. So even when we're not conscious of that, our actions will show that, because that's what brainwashing per se does. It makes sure that you maintain the actions to keep this system going. So even when you're conscious of what's going on around you, we all can still fall into that same trap or that same thing that we've been taught, which says that we're less, I'm less because I'm a black woman, because I'm black and I'm a woman. So I'm at the bottom. That's not something that's in there.
We're a double strike. Double strike.
Right. Double strike. Yeah. And so it goes, so we have to unlearn that.
Some of the things that, you know, I you know, because I totally 100% agree with my sister lady You know, I think that my sister has endured much in a lot of these spaces, you know, as mm-hmm. you know, Stacy has as well. You know, Scott, brother, I don't know you, but I'm sure you have as well. I think that we need to also realize that from the beginning, you know, Black people have valued, as well, you know, under a system of white supremacy, the voices and opinions of white people above their mm-hmm. own. You know, it is to the point to where if you, you know, I have taught, you know, a lot of Black authors when I teach my literature class, and I would talk about racism. And, you know, my classes usually had, you know, mostly all Black people, one or two white students. And even in that space with one white student, they were really, really concerned about how she felt.
Right.
You know, and I'm just like, wait a minute. It's also down to, you know, when white people are afraid to be called racist, as if being called racist is worse than experiencing actual racism. I give a shout out to my white allies, you know, people I know who are definitely down for our folks, who acknowledge that even if they are the only white voice in the room, they still have more power and more privilege,
right.
you know, being
right.
that only one person. And that, you know, some of us will fall all over ourselves, fall on people to protect these people. And yet, we don't see that reciprocation.
Right. And I think, too, to add with that, completely agree with that. And I think, too, that a lot of that is also, too, our power dynamic, that we can't leave out the structure of white supremacy. So when your resources, when your pay, when your cash flow, when your house, when your car, when all of that is supplied to you via your money, but through a white entity that sits at the top, that's just the reiteration of that value. And I think that's part of, too, what we are working towards changing. I think it has been. We've had great steps through history, through our ancestors that changed that. But that's also a part of capturing an entire nation's mind to view people as superior, because all at the highest levels we have, it is controlled by this one dominating group, which is white men.
Well,
and that's really deep.
I would also
when you
say
take that through history.
That, yeah. White women are also underneath white men, but they are
right.
up there regardless.
Right.
Right. There right. is a pecking order. I mean, we've established we're always at the bottom. but like you said, even though white women are being marginalized by white men, you're still better off than me. And I think that's
right.
a very difficult concept to get across to some of our allies. I think one of the things that I is my personal thing, I think we often misconstrue the definition of the words racism and bigotry. They are different.
Yes.
And, you know, we'll hear people say, well, that's racist. No, it's not racist. It's bigoted, but it's racist.
Right.
And then, you know, they'll throw it at him. You said this, you know, but they'll say, a black person will say something that is really a bigoted statement, and they'll go, well, you're a racist because you said that. I mean, it's gotten to the point, if I say the word white, and that was a conversation, Dawn, I think you remember the conversation we had about white people.
Oh, yeah.
And
oh, yeah.
That was kind of right. stunning, because we all of a sudden, these people, you know, we had white progressives coming in, and they were lecturing us on it, and we were like, whoa, wait a minute, hold up. I mean, we had a dissertation about theology and archaeology, and we were like, wait a minute. We both were like, we need to pump on the brakes. And it was kind of stunning, but I think we need to understand what the words mean and use them in the proper context.
Yes.
And then we also have to have an understanding of, you know, there's covert racism and then there's overt racism. We're really
right.
good with identifying the overt, you know?
Thank you.
I mean, we're like, but when it comes to covert, I don't think white people understand exactly what it looks like and how sometimes they unwittingly do it. And, I, you know, one of the things both of you ladies brought up is about the struggle that organizers see, particularly black organizers see in white organizations. And, you know, I'm not trying to mess up nobody's money or anything, you know, but
right.
Because, you know, it's kind of an, it's, I don't think progressive organizations understand how they are structured. You know, I have seen time and time again, white organizers come in from out of town.
Uh-huh.
And they come in, and they've got the full backing of this organization. And you may have black organizers in the area who know the lay of the land, who have those connections. You know them because they call you up. Hi, how you doing? My name's so-and-so. I'm new to the area, and somebody told me to call you because you know everybody. And the first thing I'm thinking is like, well, you're going to have to do what I did. You're going to have to meet these people and build those relationships. You know, how am I going to let you slide in the home plate? And I'm sitting up here hungry, you know, because I'm trying to make a living at doing what I love. And I don't know if it's unwittingly done or with a sense of purpose, but we have seen quite a bit of that happen. And it's very, very frustrating to come in and watch these groups hire people, and they're like, look, these people are going to lead us all to the promised land. You just follow this particular organizer, and we're going to do this. And then we all know you're only on the ground as long as the grant money's there, you know. So
on the advocacy side, it happens on the political, operative side also. Because I know that I've seen in several occasions where you have African-American leadership starts to emerge in certain counties, whether it's county parties or state committees or whatever. You start seeing some of our white allies on the back of getting mad and not contribute as much. I remember when I became KFQ County, My white constituency walked out the room, and I hadn't even been voted on yet, just because I dared challenge the status quo.
Right.
We had a black coup. That's what they call it. The black people committed. We had a coup. Like, no, you broke the rules, and just because you was white, you thought you could break the rules, and we weren't gonna say nothing. So I mean. And got mad because we actually had some backing. I mean, so when you talk about that happening on a little bit back, you get to talking about when the African
president
runs for office.
Right.
How serious it becomes a white progressive.
Just so you know, I'm about to go through a tunnel, so if you lose me, I'll be back.
Oh, okay. Okay.
You have a white progressive that wants to run for office, and the black candidates are not even looked at seriously because, oh, we got this, we have the great white hope now. I mean, so it's bad on the political side.
Well, Scout, you know better than that. A bunch of white people get together, it's a coalition. A bunch of black people get together, they think we're trying to pull Shaka Zulu revolution on them. And so,
And if I could say something on that, too, on the addressing the part of the organization, I think, Stacey, you started that conversation. And by saying that sometimes we don't think that white people are aware of what's going on, I think a lot of times what happens that is not also part of the conversation is sometimes there is an awareness of what's going on. But the truth is that privilege and the system benefits a particular group. And so it's, do you risk completely speaking out against these things or changing it in your organization when because of the system you are benefiting from it? So it doesn't mean that I won't address systemic racism. I want to address the issues in my organization that are not fair and of not a value of everybody that's present, but I have to address it in a certain way, because if I speak out too much, I lose the privilege that I have. I lose the gain that I have. I lose the money source that's coming to me because I am a black a white organization. So I think that's part of a truth that we have to be able to also speak out and speak up, especially in doing this work. That it's not all the time an ignorance to it. Sometimes it's that, you know, think about us in our own part. Are you going to sacrifice all of your benefits that you really didn't have to work for on certain levels? I'm not talking about the organization's success, but as an individual that I really had to work hard or as hard as this other sisters, am I going to sacrifice all of that to address a need that benefits another group? And sometimes the answer is no. So we get organizations that does stuff and certain organizations, nonprofits, corporate entities that will put diversity as part of the platform, but it means that we're putting this as part of the platform to let everybody know we're the good white people, we're the good people, but we're not going to actually practice this, because practicing this means I don't keep my same power. And I think
and
that that's something that
credibility when you know for me, you know, I'm very passionate. I am very my integrity is of, I don't have much, so my integrity is something that I protect very fiercely. But when I see organizations do that, when you make that decision, you're basically throwing the people that you advocate for under the bus for that dollar. And that's kind of, you know, part of the trouble that we deal with externally with the enemies that, you know, our external enemies that we know of. And it's been difficult for me because there have been times when it's like, okay, I could suck it up and I could take this, you know, I see what they're doing. And then, you know, the whole left side, right side brain thing. And the right side of my brain is like, oh, hell no, they're trying to play you. And they're not really helping you. They're using you. So I do get it, though. I mean, we have to, I think one of the things we need to do is to find, we're under the thumb of these funding sources.
Right.
And that, you know, at the end of the day, we have to be beholden to, you know, what the dollar says. So maybe one of the solutions is to create a funding source to support organizations like you, where you can maintain your integrity and you're not under the heel. We need a George Soros for black people. And if there's anybody out there listening,
That's something that whether we're talking organizations, whether we're talking about just our every day-to-day lives, just some which a lot of folks listening may already know, but one industry, just a corporate industry, hair products. Hair products, I don't know about this year, but in 2013, 80% of all profits from hair products came from black people.
Mm-hmm.
80% of all. At one time, I don't know what the figures are this year, but at one time, over 60% of profit generated, not overhead, but profit generated here in the United States came off of less than 13% of the population, which are black people.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you think about that, we're making the least, but we're paying out the most. And I'm using that to say that what you just, the solution, or one of the things that you just said within organization, it rings through just throughout our everyday life, our economic life. You know, where is the money source coming from us? Where, because money and white supremacy are in the system that we have, and I keep speaking of that because it is really understanding the system, in my opinion, how we function in the system, and that's for all races, for white people, understanding what you have under white supremacy and what black people had, or what our roles in it, or what our roles are in, under white supremacy. So to look at that, whether it's an organization, whether it's a union, and I'm a promoter of unions, whether
love
it's your everyday jobs, whether it's running the household. The truth is, the same mentality that was on the plantation, which where you had your masters and you had your plantation workers, those are the same mentalities that work throughout most of our systems here, in my opinion. So when you get to organizations, you have your heads of organizations, you have your plantation workers. The plantation workers a lot of times look black, not getting paid the money that they should be getting paid, not getting the resources that we should get, and you have a group that's profiting off of that. You take that through some of our other organizations, you have the same thing. You take that through your businesses, through stores, through major corporations, it looks the same way. So I think that that's something that we really have to uplift, and as far as white folks, white people's role in that, they have to understand that and actually be willing to say, I am not okay with profiting off of this system in this way. I'm not okay with my role having privilege at the expense of black people in this country. And that's a hard transition to get to, because it's more to do it in action. It takes a lot more to actually show that in action than it does to verbally say that or put a phrase up on whatever you're doing to say, look, I love black people, and it's not about that. It's about the system that continues no matter how you feel individually. It's about the system that we're participating in that continues to make it that continues to produce inequality for black people, continue to murder black people, continue to kill us at all costs, and continues to pimp us out. And you have to be willing to say, I'm not okay with that, and I'm still not okay with that, even if it means I lose my privilege. And that's a hard thing for people to actually grasp. No matter what you are or what that is, it's a hard thing to say. I'm sacrificing my privilege, all of those things that helped me get to where I go, at the expense of sharing it with someone else. And that's really hard. So I think that's part of the work that has to be done.
Sometimes I don't think it's necessarily all about them surrendering their privilege, but sometimes recognizing that they can use their privilege to better our situation. Because a lot of times they use it when like we said, when we get in situations where they start feeling uncomfortable, they utilize their privilege to get out of the uncomfortable situation instead of saying, okay, I have this privilege, I can make it through. Let me bring some of the rest of you through with me because I have this privilege. But they don't. They back out there. I'm uncomfortable.
Right.
I got to go.
Right.
I see y'all on the other side. But instead of saying, I'm going to ride through with y'all and I'm going to use my privilege to help you carry through.
Right. Because, you know, for me, you know, I hear a lot of people, well, I'm an ally. I went to this event and I was there. Okay. That doesn't make you an ally.
Right.
Okay. That doesn't make you an ally. You came to an event and we thank you for coming and everything, but that doesn't make you down with the movement. So, what are some of the ways and you two ladies and teens where whites can be better allies? Because I'm like, my thing is go talk to your people, because we've been trying to talk to them for a couple of centuries and they ain't trying to hear it. Maybe they'll listen to you. So, you know, for me, that's the one thing I can tell people, because one of the things I found fascinating was, like, when everything started jumping off.
Did you drop off just then, Stacey? Are you still there? Stacey?
You know, teach me about racism, and I'm like, come on now. You know, I'm not the racism sensei. So, which is why I got you two ladies on to help us out. So, to help white people, because I really, you know, it's been painful watching some of them try to work through this. How can they be better allies to the black community?
Right. And, Don, if you don't mind, can I say something really quick? I'm going to have to come off the call, but I know Don can bring the rest of it and close that out.
I'm back now.
Okay. So, I do think you were right on about white people being able to actually have this discussion in white spaces. and confront their own friends, their own associates with these issues. When it comes up, it may be uncomfortable, but to directly oppose it or directly start to have those conversations in their own circles. I also think that another way that white people can be allies in this particular struggle is by showing up in support roles. Actually being able to accept that this is not a role, this is not a space, this is not a time where my leadership needs to show up, more so my support in this. And that means sometimes taking directions from black leaders, taking directions from people in your circle, whether it's that one black friend that you have, whether it's your coworkers at work, to actually listening and taking directions from, not actually feeling like I have to lead or my place in this is to show up and teach them how they should be or teach them the solutions. This is a time to not teach, but to learn. To learn,
right,
to support and do the opposite of what you've maybe been able to do throughout your lifespan, however many years that is, but switch that and turn your role, support role, learn role, be a student. Talk to your home. If you want leadership, take leadership in your own circles and in your own group.
How about just taking it as far as you want to do something to the table?
Okay. I'm so sorry. I have so much going on in my area. I agree with Lady 100%. I agree with her so much. I will also add, I think I said this before, that, you know, we tend to learn a lot more when we listen. You know, we tend to learn a lot more. And you know what? My folks have been saying this for years. And, you know, I think that Lady said something profound when she said that, you know, while it might be unintentional for some people, it is very intentional for other people. I remember when leaders, even though I might not agree with them politically, have said some things and people have interpreted their recitations of, you know, white supremacist violence.
Hello?
I think we lost her. She'll be back.
She's still
she probably went to the tunnel. Yeah.
No, she's still
so.
And the video by one white brother who responded to Bernie Sanders supporters, and what he said over and over was listen. And I'm just like, you know, if you won't listen to us and you won't listen to your own folks, then you're not trying to be an ally.
Now, that is something, you know, if, you know, I was with the coffee party. Y'all don't laugh. But I was with the coffee party, and that was one of the things. It was helped to foster dialogue. And I think what we do in America, we got the hollering and the wailing and the moaning and gnashing the teeth. We got that part down real good. What we don't do enough of is listen. Or we listen with the intent of forming our own reply and opposition instead of actually listening and processing to what was said. So that's very powerful, what you just brought up there, because, you know, it's like, listen, yeah, I did listen, but I heard you, still don't agree with it, but this is my side. And that's something we see a lot of. Scott, I know you see a lot of that.
Yeah, I do. And we listen, but we lost her again. So we can carry the conversation until she comes back up. But you know, yeah, I have experienced a lot of that.
And we
listening to
Lady.
You want to
talk about Exhibit A? Do you want to talk about Exhibit A that we had yesterday?
Yesterday we had some issues. We were talking about. A black issue we were talking about. We were talking about the black elite and inside of our own structure. And we had a white ally come in, and I've been basically redirected, devolved the whole conversation. And, I mean, it was disturbing to me to the point that I almost, you know, wanted to contact this person on the sidebar and say, hey, you know you was wrong for going at it the way that you did, because you basically attempted to derail a project, or talked about derailing a project that was actually helping out in our community that was not even things I mean, but you were prepared to take your knowledge and your privilege to undermine something that was good for our community. That should have never been an option. And that always has been something that bothers me, that when we have, like you said, you have people with knowledge and resources and they want to attempt to use the knowledge and resources as a leverage point to bully their way to see your their point of view over your point of view or the point of view of the community. I mean, when you get to doing stuff like that, you're no longer an ally. You're a fifth columnist. And that,
yeah.
That's disturbing.
That's it right there.
Say it.
Oh, you're still there, Dawn. Okay.
Yeah, I just went through another tunnel.
Yeah, I figured that. We were talking about a conversation, you know. I don't know why y'all keep tagging me and stuff on Facebook, but I got tagged into this conversation, and
like
I mean, it was
from
Scout page.
The conversation. You were actually in the beginning
going on.
When you posted it, I wanted you to be aware of the original issue we were talking about. And, you know, so you was in there at the beginning with this person that came in, this ally that came into the conversation, wasn't even invited to the conversation. They invited themselves.
Of course. That's
right.
The entitlement.
Well, I wouldn't – I mean, I'm going to question the word ally because you know her. I don't. And she really did not leave me with a ally-y feeling. You know, she came off, and there may be some history back there. You did tell me that there might be some factors. But the way she came off was just, I mean, it was a sister who was trying to open up a daycare in Philly. She's also feeding children during the summer months, and she's trying to get resources up. And, you know, we were discussing on how she could better raise money and, you know, offering advice. And this chick came in, and she was like, you know, I was like, at one point I wanted to ask her, did she sleep with your man? Does she owe you money? Because she was going in on the chick and kind of trying to disparage her character and questioning her ethical integrity. And you know me, I had, you know, I kind of unleashed the Kraken on her, but she needed to see where she was dead wrong and what she was doing. And at one point I asked her because it kind of, the conversations evolved into really irrelevancy. And she was like, well, she was talking about her experience as an infectious control person. And it was like, well, you know, offer her services on how she can make this better. And then she's like, well, I'm just going to call the city on her. And it was like, really? Really, you going to do this? And it was kind of funny. It was a whole lot of sad. But it's kind of the experience that we have sometimes when trying to discuss issues with us. And I really got a beef with the, you know, when blacks are talking about racism or things that affect them, and then you get the, yeah, me too. I got a problem with that. You know, it's like, well, I was, you know, one time I experienced racism. No, you didn't. You did not experience racism.
The police stopped me, and it was completely unjustified.
It was totally unjustified, and I was just really, really mad, and I'm going to call my elected official. You know, and it's like, no, you can't have this. Unfortunately, you know, I appreciate you with your attempts at making solidarity, and some people do it unwittingly, but I need to put a mic check on folks. You can't have that. You just can't. I mean, you know, I had a girlfriend who said, black folks can't have nothing. You know, and it's true. We can't even, she was like, we can't even own our own misery, you know, our own oppression. We can't even own that. They want to take that too. And I think white people need to understand that's how we feel when you do that. And it may not be done with any intent or malice, but that's exactly what you put out when you do that. So, you know, I'm really hoping that this conversation will help some people get over it
it may help them be a better ally, because what we saw last week was absolutely uncalled for. And then people are like, well, I'm not going to support Black Lives Matter anymore. Well, if you can say that, you never was.
Thank you.
If you can say that so quickly, you never was.
You don't matter.
Because
you know,
and we heard a lot of that.
I totally agree with that. I mean, a lot of people always say that, you know, if we say things the right way, if our tones, if men would lower their voices and speak in submissive tones and stuff like that, that would be okay. You know, that, you know, Black women, you know, are angry, Black men are angry. Well, they're angry because nobody is listening. And the thing is that if I got to tell you that I'm bleeding in a polite voice, then I need to ask somebody else.
And see, that's something that really, you just hit something on the head there, because when you get to thinking about African Americans and how we have to operate inside the corporate space or anything else,
mm-hmm.
I remember when I first transitioned at my job from being a production worker into, you know, administrative and support roles, you know, where I was, you know, lending support to the management team. I was told so many different things that I could no longer do. And I had Black leadership that was telling me this, be like, listen, for you to go, if you're going to talk to the, you know, the guys from corporate, you can't wear a beard and a mustache anymore. You can't do this. You can't do that. If you are upset, then, you know, you need to, you know, if somebody says something that's upsetting you, please don't let it show on your face, because they're looking for the angry Black male. And I'm like, whoa, really? But
I'm so
being
tired
that I was
of that.
Dumb and didn't know any better, I went ahead along with the cause of what you wanted me to do. But we have to operate in their spaces a certain way, but our lives ask them to act a certain way in our spaces, and that's unfair.
Right. And, you know, I get tired of the whole angry thing, because you know what I find really funny? You know, they tell us, well, you know, you have to tone it down. You have to use those soft, sultry tones. Don't upset them, you know. And then when you watch white comedians like Louis Black, who's the epitome of the angry white man, okay? When you
and they
see,
love it.
They love it. And when they're challenging, you know, certain power structures, even though they may be white, they go berserk. You know, when they go on epic rants, but then when it comes to us, you have to be very, very, very sublime. You know, be very subdued in your comments. You know, we want you to dress in a way. Don't come with that Afrocentric stuff. Don't wear that. You know, you may make people uncomfortable. I'm not trying to make you comfortable. I'm trying to save my people. I'm trying to save my son. I'm trying to save, you know, my daughters. You know, I'm not trying to make you comfortable. And I'm very tired of the, you know, progressives seem to be race neutral and how they look at things. If one more person tells me we have to be part of this society where, you know, I'm tired of having this conversation about my Blackness and how I'm being asked to subvert or curtail my Blackness in order to make you feel comfortable. You do not
you
have the Latino community to do that. You don't ask the Asian community to do that. But when I talk about my Blackness and my pride in my Blackness, all of a sudden I become this threat. Oh, she done went and got radical. And I think Angela Davis said it best, radical meant grabbing something at the root. So if you're going to call me radical, I'll be that. But what I'm not going to do, what we're asking, and what I think white people don't understand, well, we're asking you to acknowledge our Blackness and not to be afraid of it, you know, not to, because that's buying into the stereotype that you've been fed. And Black people have been fed into the stereotype that Blackness is something that should be brought, toned down and brought. We want to be able to embrace it, and we want it to have it respected. We want it to have, you know, equality. We don't want to become part of a homogenous society, you know, or sort of, you know, the old I taught the world this, you know, the Coca-Cola commercial, you know.
Oh, Lord, yes.
I just have a real problem with that. And when you say that, people are like, well, Stacey, you're racist. Okay, boy, girl, bye. You know, I just can't do it anymore. And it's exhausting to keep having these conversations over and over and then try to have people come and argue with you, you know. And I'm like, but you don't have these arguments with any other culture except us. And
because
I don't
know. The thing is, you sit there and you watch us have to seduce who we want to be. And I can tell you right now, and if any members of the Democratic Party are gonna finna get pissed at me because I'm finna tell it. We are always smiling and shuffling Negroes inside of the meetings. Okay? We always smiling and shuffling. You don't see, we don't talk. I mean, even the freaking African-American.
He's right.
He is.
We shuffle and smile. We never, ever really push our issues. You can look at it. You can look at a body of people who are majority African-American and have very little representation on the doggone Democratic National Committee. Why? Because we'll never push for ourselves, because if we push, then we look like that we might be in a tad bit aggressive. We don't never talk about our issues, and it, specifically to our issues, even inside of our own caucuses. That when we had our caucus, white people were allowed to vote in our space on who our leaders would be.
See,
in the black caucus.
No. Yeah, I'm not feeling that at all.
And that was, and people was like, okay. And I was like, that's what they want to do, fine. But it's not right. And people spoke out against it, and it looked like the leadership was, like, ready to go off because why y'all wanted to be exclusive? I mean, you don't see me running over to the Latino caucus. I definitely don't show over at the Women's Caucus. I don't go over there trying to vote for their leaders. I go over there and I support. I go to the Democratic Women's Federation. I go in there and support. I pay my dues. I eat their meals. But I never try to take and enforce my views upon them because, one, I'm not a woman. So why can a white person affect and push their views upon me as an African-American? It makes no sense.
Do they do that for the Latino caucus?
I put black issues when they affect rural Georgia, and they black issues, I push it. But at the same time, you need to calm that down. You don't need to push
what?
That because some of the consistency is white. But this issue affects my people. They need to understand it affects my people. Because then you understand what it's crazy. And I get so tired when white people, we are showing our teeth 100% of the time. And even when we're mad, we got to leave the room to talk about we pissed off.
Well, something that I want to point out, because, we would be remiss if we did not, while we're talking about the white supremacist state, while we're talking about these caucuses and the like, why is it that there is this push for white control of even black-dominated spaces? I mean, don't be fooled. There are, white people who influence black people to occupy some of these black spaces. Let us not forget that COINTELPRO happened in this country, and that there was the Puerto Rican resistance movement.
Yes.
There was the Chicano resistance movement. And last but not least, there was the black liberation movement, and that these were systemically destroyed through COINTELPRO, leaders murdered, people discredited, and spread apart. So what they do not want to do is they do not want black people to, first of all, be themselves. One thing you're not going to see on Facebook being passed around as a meme, because there's one thing that I don't like to see. Everybody talking about cops, they're going to show that white cop hugging that crying black kid. They're not going to show a black cop hugging a crying black kid. Do you know that black cops are the fathers of black children? But we won't show that because black cops' humanity is not at stake here unless he's ushering a white supremacist in South Carolina. Those are always political. What they want to do is they want to promote this idea of peace, and there is no peace without justice. There is no peace without justice at all. Yeah. And for you to try to control the narrative to the point to where you even have, you know, these so-called good slave owners. I'm going to tell y'all, I'm not a fan of Thomas Jefferson. You can look at the notes on the state of Virginia, query 14, paragraph 264, where he said, hey, you know, I'm for abolition, but we got to get black folks out of here because they might do so. They might do unto us, you know, what
as
we have
as
done,
they
unto
have
them.
Done unto, right. And we're
so
going to have to leave
actually,
that as the last word.
We're going to have to do this all day.
You got to come back, Dawn.
I'll come back.
All right, then, everybody. This is Dawn.
Thank you so much for having me on.
And Stacey Hopkins, see y'all.
All right, peace.
Bye.